Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, December 4th, 2015. You can expect no major changes to gun regulations in the United States and blame the NRA and the Congress.
Don't take my gun away from me. I'm not the man I used to be.
Each time Americans are slaughtered in a mass killing, Americans go out and buy more guns. That seems to be the sensibility in this country. And following Wednesday's mass shooting in San Bernardino, California, the House of Representatives, controlled by Republicans, voted for the third time on a simple bill that would ban people who are listed as terrorists and put on the FBI's no-fly list or terrorist watch list. It would ban them from purchasing weapons. Now, I've got my problems with this, as we'll discuss in a moment. But the failure of Congress to act on its own posturing, that we're tough on terrorism, that we'll go to war in another country, we'll send drones, we'll carpet bomb, but we will not even put common sense restrictions on access to guns in the United States. Last night I was watching coverage on the PBS NewsHour. They trotted out Michael Leiter, former director of the National Counterterrorism Center, and I can hear the howls from gun lovers across the country. As he said, well, you know, one of the big problems is that it's too easy to get guns in this country. I think that's an honest and sincere comment, but it will be interpreted by the gun nuts as, they're trying to say that to fight terrorism, I need to give up my weapons. And there, we start talking past one another, and the gridlock returns. And so, this bill was also voted on in the United States Senate, and only a single Republican, Mark Kirk of Illinois, voted for it. Then another bill that would have expanded background checks to gun show and online firearm sales to screen out convicted felons and the mentally ill failed in the Senate, and all four Republican senators running for president, Cruz, Rubio, Paul, and Lindsey Graham, voted against it. And so it really is striking and somewhat shocking to see Americans, as they continue to face these ugly scenes of gun violence and mass killing, embrace these phony solutions that the idea is more guns. Now, I don't for a minute believe that we can eradicate the scourge of weapons in our country in short order in any fashion. And the government is not going to come and pick up people's weapons and melt them down. We have so many hundreds of millions of firearms in circulation in this country that really the only hope I see is for some form of public education. Because the NRA is not going to permit any even incidental limitations on access to guns. And people continue to watch television, and they seem to be persuaded that the answer to gun violence is more guns. That's pretty sick and twisted, but that's what it seems to boil down to. Now, to the terrorist watch list and related issues, I have a lot of problems. It was interesting to see how many people say, well, of course there should be a terrorist watch list, and they should be able to, you know, monitor those people, listen into their phone calls without a warrant. It's become the new normal. And the media coverage and political reaction to events like this enable passive acceptance of even more government surveillance and collection of data. And Colleen Rowley, who has distinguished herself, she was an FBI agent and an attorney, trained as a lawyer. She blew the whistle after 9/11 on the failure of the FBI to do its job, and in particular the Minneapolis branch, in the case of Zacharias Moussaoui. And she published a piece, I'm linking to it in the show file for today's podcast, so you can read it, at the Huffington Post and its international affiliate. And she notes, first, that the visa waiver program that has become a political football since the Friday the 13th attacks in Paris, where one Syrian guy who came to Europe apparently with the flood of refugees is accused of being a participant. And based on that one case, we've seen the hysteria of American political candidates and lawmakers. And many Democrats voted for this draconian restriction on the granting of visas to Syrians and Iraqis and others who they are afraid of. And Colleen Rowley points out that last year, the visa waiver program, which permits citizens of friendly countries like, say, France, to enter the United States without a formal visa, it was allowing 300 times more foreign visitors into the U.S. than refugees from all countries combined. And so it is a huge group of people. The visa waiver program allowed 21 million foreign visitors from 38 countries to pass through U.S. ports of entry, according to 2013 official records. And very few problems have resulted. So 21 million people who've come in with very little scrutiny, and we want to claim that as many as 10,000 Syrians, the target for the Obama administration this year, would pose this huge threat. It's irrational, nonsensical, and it plays to the fears that have been hyped among the American public ever since 9/11. We're on this continuous level of fear and the sense that there is somebody lurking under the desk or around the corner who could do you harm. And Colleen Rowley also points out the problems with the so-called no-fly list. One of the lists is called the TIDE, Terrorist Identities Data Mart Environment, and then there's the TSDB, the Terrorist Screening Database. Now, there are about 1.1 million people on this list. And it's become so unwieldy. Nobody knows how names are put onto the list. They're nominated by law enforcement people. The level of proof required to be put on this list is unknown. It could be based just on a hunch or on suspicions, or it could be based on solid evidence. And getting off the no-fly list for innocent people has proven to be virtually impossible. And the bigger the haystack grows, the harder it is to find that proverbial needle. And so we have really gone off the rails into a kind of irrational, hysterical zone. And I'm not optimistic that we're going to get back on track anytime soon, because we now have an anonymous law enforcement official feeding to the corporate media that one of the shooters in San Bernardino, Tashfeen Malik, the female, made a post on Facebook under a different name hours before they went to the center and unleashed their bullets. And they claim that Tashfeen Malik pledged allegiance to al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, or Daesh, or whatever you care to call it. And this oath of allegiance is called a bayat in Arabic. Now, the posting has been removed, so we have to trust these government sources who won't name themselves that this information is accurate and that it has some meaning. And it's entirely possible that these two people, Malik and her husband Farouk, were inspired by Anwar al-Awlaki, by jihadi videos, or other messages that they received. But the anonymous official is saying that they do not believe that there's evidence that the Islamic State directed this event in Southern California. Nonetheless, just this little tidbit of information is going to send the right wing spinning way out of control. They'll blame Obama, and they'll claim that we need to bomb Syria or round up Syrians, round up Muslims in the United States. All of these actions ineffective and un-American. Meanwhile, at the White House, they continue to search for ways to bypass Congress, to ratchet up gun regulations in some form or another. And basically, they come up empty-handed. Because some of the actions that Obama could take, like to redefine what a gun dealer is, to put more gun sellers under regulations that are tighter, well, that's going to lead the NRA and its allies in Congress to go ballistic, to go postal. And so there is no easy route forward. And in an interesting commentary published at Al Jazeera today, Ali Gharib, who has written for The Nation and other publications, makes an important point. He said that, look, you know, when these mass shootings occur, Americans say we need to take action, but nothing happens. And he writes, the contrast with incidents perceived as acts of international terrorism, which in practice usually means attacks by Islamic extremists, is striking. These events, too, are met with the same impulse that we must do something. But in these cases, action seems to come easy. Not only does public policy shift quickly, but something that typically gets done, a military intervention abroad, often carries incredible costs, and political elites and the public seem not to fret about that very much. And he goes on to note that after the Oregon shooting, just a couple of months ago, the number of respondents opposing tougher gun laws actually went up. And he asks, why are such common sense measures like the background checks and the no-fly list restriction on gun purchases, why are they so tough to get through the political gauntlet? Well, he blames money and politics. And on that score, he's absolutely correct. His closing line, when it comes to protecting Americans from untimely violent deaths, as with so many other issues facing Washington, action is capable only of following the money. And an interesting editorial in my local paper, the San Francisco Chronicle, today, noting that 15 years ago, a Republican member of Congress from Arkansas, Jay Dickey, authored a bill that banned research into gun violence. And now, Jay Dickey has decided that that was a mistake. On Wednesday, he issued a statement, research could have been continuing on gun violence without infringing on the rights of gun owners, in the same fashion that the highway industry continued its research on head-on collisions without eliminating the automobile. Well, that's a pretty elementary metaphor that he used there, but I'm glad to see that at least one Republican gun nut could be put in the category of former gun nut. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Casey Condon is a $10 a month supporter. John Fritsch, Anna Gordonier, and Mona Kobus are regular subscribers as well. I invite you to join their ranks. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. I need some new subscribers. We're getting to the end of the year. And the way this thing works, it's normal. People come and go as subscribers. Some people stick with us for, I've been doing this for 6 years, and there are a handful of people who've been subscribing since the beginning and still support me. But I understand people come and go. They have different interests, different demands on their pocketbook. And so it's your turn. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. The menu button is in the upper right corner on the homepage. There you click and you pull down Become a Subscriber. Click on that. And on the next page, you can choose 5, 10, 20 a month. You can give me a one-time contribution of any amount via PayPal or mail in a check or cash or money order, whatever you prefer. The P.O. box is listed right there. And the annual subscription is $50. That's a really good deal. And you get my bonus gift if you're a brand new subscriber from anywhere in the world. You get a copy of the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's Empire of Chaos. And I'm a little behind on sending those out to new subscribers, so bear with me. I'll get to that in the next few days, I hope. Well, the noise level of the war of words between Moscow and Ankara, Turkey, continues to rise. And yesterday, Vladimir Putin gave his annual State of the Federation speech, and he opened by tweaking the Turkish leadership and referring to the shootdown of the Russian fighter jet on November 24th because Turkey said it violated its airspace for 17 seconds. Putin said, "Allah only knows why they did it." Now, this is quite a tweak. He didn't publish a cartoon of the prophet. But here is the leader of the world's most famous atheist nation tweaking Turkey by saying, well, Allah only knows why they did it. He went on to say, probably, Allah decided to punish Turkey's ruling clique by depriving it of sense and reason. And then he kind of stopped the venomous talk and just went to the threat level. He said, if they expected a nervous or hysterical reaction from us, if they wanted to see us become a danger to ourselves as much as to the world, they won't get it. We are not going to rattle the saber. But if someone thinks they can commit war crimes, kill our people, and get away with it, suffering nothing but a ban on tomato imports, as well as a few other restrictions in construction or other industries, they are delusional. Now, the other move that Russia has made is to move its air defense system, the S-300 missiles, into Turkey and their base at Latakia. And this is drawing anger from Jerusalem, where the Israelis say that this will constrain their ability to attack at will Iran's alleged nuclear facilities. Well, that's an interesting wrinkle. And speaking of Iran's alleged nuclear facilities, the International Atomic Energy Agency is about to issue its final report, and this is part of the agreement with Iran that was struck by the U.S. and five other nations earlier this year. And the part of it was that Iran had to, so they used the terms, come clean about its past involvement in the development of nuclear weapons. Now, as Gareth Porter, the independent journalist, has said on this program many times, and he detailed in his important book called Manufactured Crisis, Iran has not had a nuclear weapons development program for years, perhaps as long as 11 years. And yet Washington and the corporate media maintain this fiction that Iran is lying and hiding this, and that, we really need to force them to tell the truth. And David Sanger, who is the Washington bureau chief of the New York Times, published an opinion piece they call News Analysis in Friday's paper. And he's raising these questions. First, he accuses Obama of just ignoring the historical issue because he felt it was far more important to deal with the future than to force it to admit to a program it has long contended never existed. Well, I believe that contention, but most of the American media and the American political class do not. And so Sanger continues, the decision to essentially close the file raises questions over whether the world's nuclear watchdog has lost its ability to strike fear into nations secretly pursuing the bomb. And if Iran could avoid fully answering many of the questions about 12 different technologies it was pursuing, will it be emboldened to stiff-arm inspectors as they seek to enforce the nuclear deal? Well, this again just shows how Washington works on its own fictional narratives. And even after this deal has been reached, the U.S. is clinging to this notion, even though our own national intelligence estimates have made clear there has been no active Iranian nuclear program for years. And that is the bizarre world that we live in. Now, here's an example. The German government has repudiated a report that surfaced from its intelligence agency, the BND, that was unusually honest about the government of Saudi Arabia. And it reads in part, "The cautious diplomatic stance of the older leading members of the royal family is being replaced by an impulsive policy of intervention." The memo, which is titled "Saudi Arabia, Sunni Regional Power Torn Between Foreign Policy Paradigm Change and Domestic Policy Consolidation," was 1.5 pages long. Now, we're not hearing much about the rest of this memo, but it reportedly describes how the new leader of Saudi Arabia, King Salman, has installed his son, Prince Mohammed, and given him great power. He's defense minister, deputy crown prince, oversight over oil and an economic policy, and he is running the war in Yemen. So this appears to be blunt honesty from the BND. But the German government, fearful of a fallout with the Saudi royal family, is trying to paper it over. And here comes an interesting commentary from Michael Pizzi, writing in Al Jazeera today. And he notes that the recent decision by Germany, which is providing non-combat support to the fight against the Islamic State, following those by France and the United Kingdom to join the air campaign in Syria, collectively marked the most significant sharing of a burden borne principally by the United States since the strikes began. But analysts say it also serves up a reminder that the air war against the Islamic State is now largely a U.S. and European affair, with negligible involvement by Arab countries. Now, you remember when Obama launched this without congressional approval in September of 2014, they made a big deal about how Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Jordan, Qatar, they were all involved in the airstrikes on Syria. And I believe it was Jordan that even had a female pilot who was running some of these raids. Well, today, there is almost non-existent air support from those people described as allies. That over the past 14 months, the U.S. has carried out 95% of the coalition airstrikes in Syria. In August of this year, it was 99%. Now, we've heard a lot of noise from France and now Britain launching their airstrikes into Syria, but it's described as showing off force without any clear strategy. And according to the independent monitor Air Wars, there were 26 reported coalition airstrikes in Syria last week, and two of them were French. So the reality is very different from the spin that is being presented in the corporate media, and that's not only here in the United States. Well, yesterday, Donald Trump, along with all of the other remaining Republican candidates, total of 14 of them, went to kneel down and seek approval from Sheldon Adelson and his Zionist friends at a confab in Washington. And Ben Carson blundered. It's one of the first times he gave a speech from a text, and by all accounts, he wasn't very effective. And he kept referring to Hamas as hummus. And hummus, of course, is the chickpea delight that Arabs and others enjoy with pita bread. But Trump went in and told offensive, made attempts at jokes that were offensive to Jews and that played on stereotypes. At one point, he said, he brought up the stereotype of Jewish people as hard-nosed negotiators. Is there anyone that doesn't renegotiate deals in this room? Perhaps more than any room I've ever spoken to. And then he tweaked the pro-Israel group there by saying, you just want to give me money, and you're not going to support me, even though you know I'm the best thing that could happen to Israel. I know why you're not going to support me, because I don't want your money. You want to control your own politician. He went on to say that he wasn't ready to say whether Jerusalem should be split into two. He said, I want to wait until I meet with Bibi, referring to Netanyahu. And then the crowd started to heckle him, and he said, who's the wise guy? Do me a favor. Just relax. You'll like me very much. So then he doubled down on a comment he had made to a reporter the day before and said, I don't know that Israel has the commitment to make peace. And I don't know that the other side has the commitment to make it. Now, you're not supposed to say that to a Zionist audience. It's really clear that Israel doesn't want peace. They just want to get rid of as many Palestinians as they can. But you're not supposed to say that. And so here is a case where the loose lips and the intentionally politically incorrect talk of Donald Trump actually led to at least a moment of truthiness. This week in the Capitol, it was yesterday, George W. Bush and Dick Cheney appeared as a bust of Cheney was unveiled in the Capitol Rotunda. And W. said that he had talked to his dad, who recently criticized Cheney for his role as vice president in his son's administration. He said, Dad perked up. Send my best regards to old iron ass. So they bantered and joked around and, you know, lavishly praised one another. But very few Democrats attended. Joe Biden was about the only one. He said he's an old friend of Dick Cheney's, and even though they disagree, he says, I actually like Dick Cheney. Well, yeah, I guess politicians have bonds that go deeper than we think in many respects. But this is a really ugly event. Dick Cheney should not be honored. He should be in jail. And, for that matter, so should the Joker-in-Chief, George W. Bush. Finally, part of their legacy is the mess left in Afghanistan, where we have squandered over $800 million in reconstruction programs and efforts to what's called jumpstart the Afghan economy, which is silly. You can't jumpstart an engine that doesn't run. But the latest disclosure from the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction, John Sopko, is that we squandered $150 million on luxury accommodations and private security guards aimed at wooing corporate executives who would be brought to Afghanistan to be offered investment opportunities on the cheap. And so they built this fancy-pantsy place, a villa, with a fully staffed kitchen, open 24 hours a day. Next to it was the investor villa outfitted with upgraded furniture and three-star accommodations. And if you want to know the details of these misguided programs, read Peter Van Buren's book, We Meant Well. Van Buren's been on our program many times since he published that book and became an inadvertent State Department whistleblower. And while he revealed no classified information, his book was deeply embarrassing to his boss, Hillary Clinton, because he showed in a very humorous way how he was told to spend our money on projects that had no possible benefit to the people of Iraq. And the most interesting was a chicken processing plant that we spent millions of dollars on, and we demonstrated it to visiting dignitaries, and it never processed a single chicken, because nobody bothered to check to find out that Iraqis don't eat processed chicken. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the podcast that you're free to share with absolutely everyone, and I hope you will. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.